ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Winnie.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we're joined once again by James McWilliams, agricultural historian and author. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news. Consumers Union thinks government regulators and pork producers need to take some additional steps to ensure the safety of pork. Last month, Consumer Reports released a major new study on the safety of pork that found that 69% of the pork chops and ground pork tested contained Yersinia enterocolitica, a bacteria that causes foodborne illness. Salmonella and staph also showed up in the test. In addition, almost all of the bacteria found on pork were resistant to one or more antibiotics. Also, 20% of the samples tested contained levels of ractopamine, a growth-promoting drug that's banned in the European Union and China on safety grounds. Consumers Union, the advocacy division of Consumer Reports, believe these results are serious cause for concern, and they're urging the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to reduce these pathogens and to eliminate ractopamine from pork products. The pork industry, focused on its bottom line, unfortunately responded by attempting to shoot the messenger. The pork industry attacked the study's sample size as too small and called the story sensationalism. Consumer Union also urges the industry and the FDA to eliminate use of antibiotics in pork production except for the treatment of sick animals. More than a dozen major medical organizations, including the American Medical Association, the Infectious Disease Society of America, and many more, all believe that antibiotic use in animals is an important contributing cause of resistance problems in humans, and that the use of these drugs should be prohibited for growth promotion in animals.
Underwater Times reports that a bottlenose dolphin was found dead on December 8th in Sarasota, Florida. The dolphin was examined by Moat Marine Laboratory scientists who report that it most likely died from swallowing fishing gear. The female dolphin was 27 years old, relatively young, and was part of the year-round resident population of bottlenose dolphins in Sarasota Bay. Fishing line was wrapped tightly and in a slipknot around the dolphin's gooseneck, the flexible tube connecting the blowhole to the lungs, likely leading to asphyxiation. The line was stretched tight and connected to a hook embedded in the dolphin's forehead. Except for the fishing line and hook, the dolphin appeared to be in excellent condition, according to the director of the Sarasota Dolphin Rescue Program. She was one of the largest resident females of Sarasota Bay at nearly 9 feet long and 471 pounds, and her stomach was full of fish. Her most recent calf, born in June, has not been found and is presumed dead following the loss of its mother. This premature loss of a relatively young, productive female in her reproductive prime comes as a blow to the resiliency and sustainability of the Sarasota Bay dolphin community. Many of the dolphins have been harmed or even killed through negative interactions with humans, such as boat strikes, ingestion of and entanglement in fishing gear, and illegal feeding of dolphins. 36 stranded or dead dolphins have been recovered with signs of human action during the time period from 1984 to 2009. Lessening dolphin-human interaction is a key focus of the Sarasota Dolphin Research Program and much of Moat's education and outreach surrounding marine mammals. Bottlenose dolphins and other marine mammals are protected by the U.S. government through the Marine Mammal Protection Act and are an important part of local ecosystems.
From the Texas Tribune, a Texas law that aims to prevent puppy and kitten breeders from abusing animals faces a judicial challenge. The Humane Society of the United States and the Texas Humane Legislation Network filed an amicus brief urging the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Texas to uphold the Licensed Breeder Act, which legislators passed during the 2011 session. The law requires all dog and cat breeding organizations to receive a license from the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation and follow guidelines for animal care. The plaintiffs who filed the motion for a temporary or permanent restraining order to block the law include three breeders and a group called the Responsible Pet Owners Alliance. Opponents of the law say increased paperwork, licensing fees, and the cost of improving animal shelters and increasing the amount of veterinary care could put some breeders out of business. Dale Martinson, who breeds Cavalier King Charles Spaniels, opposed the bill when legislators considered it in 2011. After it passed, he moved to a state where breeders are licensed by the Department of Agriculture. He said he doesn't believe the court case will gain much traction because there isn't a large enough commercial kennel industry in Texas to oppose the law. The motion claims that the law is in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment because it requires some breeders to meet the new standards, while others, such as those who breed dogs for hunting and racing, do not have to. Nancy Bonner and her husband own Bonner's Bloodhounds in Sisterdale. She said the new licensing requirements were not a challenge since her breeding practices met most of them anyway. Although she's not thrilled with the $300 licensing fee she'll have to pay every year, she said the new requirements may help business in the future. But she said she understands why other breeders are troubled by the fees and paperwork requirements. She said she also worries that puppy and kitten mills will find ways to avoid inspections and circumvent the intent of the law. The best way to avoid puppy and kitten mills is to adopt an animal from your local shelter.
Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature another conversation with James McWilliams on sustainable agriculture. That's next on ACT Radio.
Joining us again on ACT Radio is James McWilliams. Last on the show, we spoke about his book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. And we also talked a little bit about Bill and Lou at Green Mountain College. Welcome back to the show, James.
Thanks for having me back.
So we'd like to pick up where we left off last time, talking about Bill and Lou, the oxen at Green Mountain College. Can you give us a brief recap of the history behind this story?
Right. So the oxen were working oxen. They worked on the school's farm. And Lou got hurt and, you know, he couldn't pull the plow anymore. These oxen primarily pulled a plow. And Bill refused to work without Lou. They'd been, you know, working together their whole lives. And the college decided that the best idea, the most sustainable idea, would be to turn them into hamburger and serve them in the cafeteria at the school. Well, there was an offer by a local farm sanctuary called Vine Sanctuary to take Bill and Lou and allow them to live out the rest of their lives on the sanctuary. And it seemed like a pretty clear choice to most people who were kind of watching this issue unfold. And there was a bit of, I guess, a sort of international outrage when Green Mountain College said, no, in fact, we're going to turn them into hamburger because it's part of our educational mission. It's all part of our quest to promote sustainable agriculture, and keeping Bill and Lou alive when they couldn't work is not sustainable. So, to me anyway, this became a very clear issue of how environmental rhetoric, particularly this rhetoric around agricultural sustainability, can be used to obscure basic ethical issues about how we treat animals. And right now we're at the point where Lou was euthanized because of his injured leg, and I would put quotation marks around euthanized because it's not altogether clear it was justifiable. And Bill is still alive and at Green Mountain College.
But I thought Bill was scheduled for slaughter. Was he not?
He was earlier on, but the university has backed off that. They have said something ambiguous like, we're going to continue to do what's best for Bill. And, of course, we don't know what that means. But they, you know, previously said, we are going to slaughter these animals on October 31st. And they didn't. And one of the reasons why they didn't is that the public response was so aggressive that protesters and activists actually approached all the slaughterhouses in the area and said, I wouldn't do this because we're going to make life a very difficult public relations issue for you if you do slaughter these animals. And they were rejected by these slaughterhouses. So it in some ways, I think thus far, despite the questionable euthanization of Lou, the fact that Bill is still alive really, I think, makes this a small victory of sorts.
The college really dug in their heels on this one, and I thought it was interesting. You had a blog about an interview with the professor there. I guess it's Fessmeyer.
Stephen Fessmeyer, yes.
And Drover Magazine. What exactly was he saying in that article?
Well, it's interesting. Fessmeyer sort of underwent this evolution during the course of the debate, and the debate really was intense for about a month. And at the beginning of the debate about the fate of Bill and Lou, Fessmeyer was like, look, you know, we have to honor everyone's opinion, and we're a community here, and we approach this issue democratically. We talked to the students, we talked to the administrators, and we arrived at this consensus. And Fessmeyer actually said, I'm a vegetarian, but, you know, I'm going to respect differences. And I just found that to be really disingenuous. Like, okay, I might think it's wrong to kill these animals unnecessarily, but, you know, if the community thinks it's right, then I'm just going to support the community. That's kind of how he began. But what happened over the course of the month was the outpouring of anger, the outpouring of argumentation against what Green Mountain College wanted to do was so intense that a kind of besieged mentality set in there. And it's almost as if those who were defending the decision on these kind of vague, you know, democratic grounds, hey, we arrived at this decision democratically, I might not agree with it, but... Well, they almost evolved into, and Fessmeyer certainly did, became angry and sort of said, you know what, we are now actually think this is the right thing to do. And, I mean, in the course of a month, Fessmeyer went from saying, you know, I'm a vegetarian who, yeah, I really don't agree with this, to giving an interview to Drover Magazine, which is a magazine, it's an industry trade magazine. And in this interview, he actually castigates the animal rights activists who were making life so difficult for him and people at Green Mountain College. He castigates them for their advocacy, which I find astounding. And in a way, he was dividing the world now into those who support the consumption of animals and those who don't. Whereas earlier on, it was divided into those who support industrial production of animals and those who don't. But by the end, quote, not the end, but, you know, after about a month of debate, here you have Fessmeyer actually colluding with the essence of industrial beef production, saying, yeah, those animal rights advocates are a bunch of nuts. They're out of touch, and they don't know what's realistic.
This is a vegetarian's opinion.
Yeah, purportedly, and it's interesting on so many levels, but how, I mean, I think when humans do become defensive, that is one of the reactions that they have, is to just dismiss those who are saying, no, answer my argument. I mean, that's all the protesters were really doing, was saying, justify this on solid moral grounds, justify your decision. And everyone at Green Mountain College tried to give an answer, and nobody did. Nobody did provide a compelling moral justification for killing the oxen. A kind of defensiveness set in, and then kind of anger. And I really felt like the decision to align GMC's interests with the National Cattlemen's Association was really an astounding example of how any reform group that says it's fighting oppression while at the same time oppressing, in this case animals, is going to end up, you know, eventually colluding with the oppressors, in this case industrial agriculture.
And how funny, too, that they based the justification for slaughtering them at first on the democratic process. And then once word got out, you know, the people spoke, you know, not just at the school, but throughout the country and throughout the world. And then all of a sudden it didn't become a democratic issue or a democracy at that point.
Well, I've been following this case so closely, and what they did was they sort of not only divided the world into those who eat, who support the consumption of animals and those who don't, they also divided the world into those of us here at Green Mountain College and those outside. I mean, in some cases, terms are used like aliens. like foreigners, aliens, you know, these extreme outsiders. And I found it to be, I mean, really kind of frighteningly parochial. And I mean, I guess I should mention that one of the reasons why I'm so close to this issue is I'm writing a short ebook on the whole event. It should come out in the next couple of months.
And that's Politics of the Pasture.
It's called Politics of the Pasture, yeah. Uh-huh.
I guess I thought it was funny, too, how the school is talking about it from a cost perspective and how it's $300 a month to feed, you know, Lou. And yet they are charging a ridiculous amount. I mean, not a ridiculous, but it is a high amount in tuition, and the school brings in quite a bit of money. What's their budget like?
Well, they have a $28 million budget, and they were arguing that keeping Bill and Lou alive would cost $300 a month. It's $24,000 a year to go to school there. Students come from all over the country. It's generally a pretty wealthy student body. The other really odd thing about making this economic case is that they are actually teaching a method of farming that is about as uneconomical as as you could get. You know, there's virtually no way that the farm that they have there at Green Mountain College could exist without, you know, the guaranteed market of the school cafeteria or the free labor provided by the students. It's not the kind of farm that could in any way survive in the open market. And by any agricultural economist standards, what they're teaching in terms of agriculture is basically how to lose money in agriculture.
Yeah, if you can get farm workers to work and pay you $24,000 a year.
Yeah, I mean,
that sounds like a great model to me.
Yeah, I mean, so that's fine, right? I mean, that's their model, but then to say that they're making their decision for strictly economic reasons, it's like, well, if you're making decisions for strictly economic reasons, you should just scratch the whole farm.
And it probably does take away from some of the principles that are actually good in that college. And it seems like they've actually now done more harm by sort of going on the offensive and emailing people who've contacted them and trying to contact their bosses. And is that still going on, to your knowledge?
I don't think that's still going on. I haven't heard much about it. But, yeah, again, up until a couple of weeks ago, the president of the university or the college was personally calling the employers of people who were writing angry letters saying, do you want your employees spending time at work writing about animal rights? And, I mean, you talk about tactics of intimidation and really kind of tyrannical practices. That pretty much epitomizes it. And it is unfortunate because, as you say, what the farm is trying to do in terms of promoting an alternative system of agriculture is based on a set of principles that I generally agree with. I think industrial agriculture is an abomination. And in many ways, what they're teaching at Green Mountain College is how to go about growing food in more responsible ways. Unfortunately, again, like much of the sustainable food movement, the reform impulse and the critical inquiry stops the minute you get to the question of animal ethics. And it is for this reason that I find myself, you know, more critical of the sustainable food movement than supportive of it. But I think on the last show we had talked a bit about veganic agriculture or pursuing some ideas of creating agricultural systems where animals are minimally exploited or not exploited at all. And that kind of stuff is happening. There are many, many veganic farms out there.
Well, there's a large movement in England, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely in England, but also in New England in the United States and in parts of upstate New York. All over the country, really, there are small-scale farms that are producing food commercially without or with minimal animal exploitation. And so, you know, my feeling is, why is the sustainable food movement, as we understand it, why are they not paying more attention to that kind of agriculture? And I think a lot of it just comes down to this unwillingness to actually look and take a serious look at questions of animal ethics. And I think that comes down to the fact that a lot of people in this movement really like their
bacon,
their meat, yeah, and, you know, are going to go to great lengths to justify consuming it.
Even as vegans, we're concerned about food safety in the food we eat, and buying organic isn't even good enough anymore when you consider the arsenic, heavy metals, antibiotics that are in manure, animal manure, that grow our crops.
Well, you know, I had a conversation yesterday, actually, with a guy who was the former head of the National Organic Standards Board, and I asked him that very question. We were talking about organic fertilizer, and I, you know, said, if a farm needs an excessive amount of fertilizer, where are they going to get manure-based fertilizer? And, of course, the answer is from CAFOs, from these, you know, confined operations. And, well, you know, that raises questions about what about the antibiotics and what about the growth hormones and what about the vaccines that are going to be in that manure. His argument was, his defense of the practice was that the composting process, if it's done properly, makes the fertilizer safe. It kind of breaks down all of those harmful chemicals.
Except and, prions, which we know can't be destroyed by heat.
You're talking about the mad cow disease, yeah. But, of course, that wouldn't come in the manure for fertilizer. That would come, like, from a rendering plant.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other interesting issue, is rendering plants are actually getting fewer and far between because of that reason. It's just so expensive now to render an animal properly because of the prion question. Huh. And so this is actually, I think, an issue that's really ripe for more investigation. What is happening to these animals that are not being rendered? I think a lot of them are being incinerated.
Oh, they're going into the air.
Yeah. but the dead stock issue, as it's called, is really one that needs to be explored. But in any case, I think that, a lot of these models that we see of as being effective, like, you know, large-scale organic agriculture, still is dependent on industrial animal agriculture for manure, and it's questionable how safe that compost is.
Well, with veganics, I guess that takes that out of the loop. And the thing is like, how do you see the veganic movement growing in the next 10 years? Do you think it's going to really take off, or do you think it's going to take a long time like the organic movement took to become more mainstreamed?
Well, I wish I could be more optimistic and say that it's going to take off. But, you know, one of the reasons why I'm so persistently critical of the sustainable food movement is their rhetoric is so convincing and their message is so popular that they have really effectively prevented a serious look at growing food without the input of farm animals. So, you know, if you sit down and just go through popular media reports looking for examples of small farms that are practicing rotational grazing, it's hard to go a day without finding a dozen articles saying, look how wonderful this is. This farmer is grazing animals and fertilizing the soil and growing crops, and it's this perfect closed loop.
No.
It never is, but that's how it's presented. I mean, those articles are easy to find. That message is out there, and it's popularly embraced. Now, try to find examples of small farms that are using cover crops for fertilizer that are not practicing rotational grazing because they don't want to exploit farm animals, but are nonetheless producing commercially viable amounts of whatever, spinach, lettuce, whatever they're growing, and try to find praiseworthy reports of those farms in the newspaper or the popular press, and you won't. It's just not on the radar screen, and I think a big reason for that is the sustainable food movement, as it's conventionally and currently framed, really doesn't have room for that kind of agriculture because, well,
they don't want to make room for it. Yeah,
it really removes this whole culinary sort of fetishization of animals off the menu, and they very much want that on the menu. And to me, it's just like, okay, if you really want reform, it might mean doing something radical, but what I see the sustainable food movement doing, you know, by continuing to endorse the consumption of animals, I just see the movement endorsing the absolute most powerful thing that industrial agriculture has going for it, which is that it's culturally acceptable to eat animals. And as long as it's culturally acceptable to eat animals, guess what? Industrial agriculture is always going to be the winner. And so I really see the sustainable food movement as little more than a kind of niche endeavor that primarily wealthier people are able to indulge in. But I don't see it as having any kind of long-term reformative impact on agriculture.
One thing that could reform is animal manure isn't necessary to grow crops. As you mentioned, there are cover crops. Compost can be made without manure. But there's also the possibility of human manure being used as fertilizer instead of just dumped into our sewers and our oceans. And the step beyond that, I'd rather have my food fertilized with manure from vegans.
Put us to good use, huh? Well, yeah, the humanure, as it's called, issue is, I think, a really fascinating one, and I did do a short blog on it. Most of the people that I've talked to who know something about this, you know, pretty much say it can be remarkably safe. It's incredibly efficient, and the major reason why it's not pursued more aggressively is because of the ick factor. People, you know, Americans are funny about that, and the idea of using our own manure to fertilize crops that will grow as plants to eat is just too difficult for a lot of people to get their minds around. But it's unfortunate because it is an enormously available and well wasted resource. Yeah. That you know, so let's exploit our own manure rather than exploit another animal's manure. One of the possible compromises here that I often bring up with people who either support or own small farms that practice rotational grazing is, you know, I will ask them, okay, if you need the animals for their manure, why don't you just let the animals provide manure for the entirety of their life? I mean, treat your farm like a sanctuary for them and let them
continue pooping?
Continue to poop for the entirety of their lives, and then let them die and rot into the soil like
yeah.
it used to be. And wouldn't that be like natural? And wouldn't that be more of a closed loop? But of course, I mean, and the answer is important. I mean, the answer is always, but that's not profitable. So you know, the rubber hits the road right there. Are we talking about an ethical system, or are we talking about a profitable system?
Right.
We've been talking with James McWilliams, historian and writer. James, can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about all your work?
Yeah, well, the best place is my blog, which is at james-mcwilliams.com.
And all your books are available, I assume, on Amazon.
My books are there. I update. I blog pretty much daily, and I also have an of interest section where I put up some interesting articles that I've been reading.
Well, thanks again, James.
Thanks, James.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Why not make a New Year's resolution to reduce or eliminate animal products in 2013? It's easier than you might think. Visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso for more information at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. And as you're making plans to celebrate Christmas and New Year's this year, keep in mind that not all wines and champagnes are cruelty-free. But you can find great options through small businesses like Vegan Sommelier. They support the vintners who embrace the idea of cruelty-free winemaking, and they only sell hand-selected vegan wines and contribute a substantial amount of the profits to the cause. You can learn more at vegansommelier.com.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh for the Animals, the Earth, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.